I'm Wenzel McGowan. I play the saxophone.
I'm Michael Wilbur. I also play the saxophone and sing.
I'm James Mushler.
And what is that thing you're in? Say it all together.
Moon Hooch.
We got you Cleveland. We got you Boston. We got you Spain, Austria, Portugal. Did I get that right? Did I get the Spain, Austria, Portugal right? You started the band in 27. You guys are all horny, and it was originally called Moon Juice. Are we done?
I think what I really want to talk about always, just because it's like a very prevalent topic that I occupy myself with, is reality. Because I think that reality is not just what it seems like. And I think that striving to find an objective reality is the wrong approach. Or it's not the wrong approach, but it's an approach that doesn't really lead to any results. Because I think that reality is something inherently subjective. That's like really what I'm like thinking a lot about. The fact that like if I look at something and perceive something a certain way, I create it and I change it. So it's like I just try to be really conscious of how I look at things, and also I have to battle with all these habits that I have of looking things in certain ways that I was conditioned to do. So I don't know, I just like the topic of reality being like a very thin, malleable, subjective thing. That's something I love talking about.
Well, I occupy my time reading a lot about environmental issues and different ways to help out with that and also be a part of that movement of keeping our natural environments alive and running. And I would, you know, you said I could say something to somebody. I would love it if my parents would just listen to me and read the articles I send them and actually think about the information I present them.
New school, what did everybody study? And how far did you go? Because new school is kind of like, you don't have to finish new school. You can take like environmental media with a slice of apple pie.
At new school, I studied music and I took also philosophy classes. To be honest, the most inspiring thing was the philosophy. Mm-hmm. Music, the music classes, the music class, I don't know, I just had such an intense teacher in Portugal that like really like drilled all these subjects of theory into my head, that at the point I got to new school, I felt kind of like I was repeating what he already taught me. And while philosophy had exposed me to totally new ideas. And I remember like getting really inspired by all these Greek philosophers. And then I had this thought of like trying to apply their philosophies. And then I once came to the philosophy class and I was like, oh, I started trying to apply the philosophy of Epictetus. And I noticed how hard it is, because Epictetus says that you should essentially not get upset about anything that's out of your control. And then I noticed I was standing in the elevator and there was somebody whistling next to me and it was bothering me. But then I was like, well, this is actually not in my control, so why would I let it bother me? And then I told that story in the class, and everybody kind of laughed at me, the fact that I was trying to apply philosophies to my life. And I don't know, that's a very memorable thing from New School. And I dropped out after 2 years.
I studied jazz performance at the New School. And I think the most memorable and most educational part of being there was just meeting incredibly creative, talented musicians and playing music with them every day and practicing with them and learning from them, my peers, because a lot of the teachers there, so there were a few progressive, like interesting teachers, but a lot of them were kind of more interested in like keeping the jazz bebop tradition alive. And I, you know, I love jazz and bebop and I learned a lot from it, but I was more interested in like creating my own music. And that's kind of why I went there, ultimately. Yeah, and then I ended up dropping out.
I was also a music performance major, and I actually ended up finishing. And, definitely the best thing about... Yeah. Yeah, the best part about being in school for me was the same thing that Mike said, the people that were there, the amazing musicians, and all the people with different outlooks on life and music, and just having such a diverse experience.
Let's talk the L train. The L train back then and the L train many years later. Because, boy, I'll tell you, when I got on the L train about 2 months ago to go, of course, to where? To see music, because of the whole place. It's kind of like L.A. is tilted towards the east and New York is tilted. I mean, the L train might as well just be on a big choo-choo train hill, right? The little train that could, because it's like the thing zooms and boom, you're in Williamsburg. And so Union Square, I'll do this for you. Crowds so much they had to like get rid of the crowds. But I'll tell you, when I was on the L train coming back from Williamsburg at 2 a.m. from something, there was a guy that was just horrendous. So the quality control, right? When you decided to do this and you said, okay, well, where are we going to perform? How did you decide on where? See, I'm coming at this a little differently. I don't want to tell the story over and over again that obviously you got your chops by playing down there and built this massive fan base that then you were able to take above ground. But what was that kind of sea change? You meet each other, you form this thing, and then you go, okay, we've got to perform. We're not going to do open mic nights. We're going to do the subway.
Well, we were all broke and needed money and didn't want to get normal jobs. Wenzel and I went to bartending school together, and then got a certificate that we then found out was completely useless. So we went to a few bars and they were just like, yeah, this means nothing. Do you have any experience? No. Well, see you later. We needed some money and we started busking and we just tried out so many different spots around the city and talked to different buskers and asked them what the best spots were. And we lived off of the L train and we always saw crowds of young people on the L train. So it was kind of like that's where people are going to dance. That's where people are going to party. And yeah, we were right.
You do that. Where's that moment where you said, okay, it's time to take this above ground?
I was thinking, are we even going to be able to entertain a crowd above ground? I wasn't really sure if it was just a subway phenomenon.
There's a more transient crowd in the subway.
Right. I just wasn't sure. So I was really nervous, actually, about this question. And then somebody asked us to play the birthday party. And we set up on a roof somewhere in Williamsburg. And people instantly started dancing.
Kids loved it.
Yeah. And the roof almost collapsed, actually, because people started jumping up and down, you know, synchronized to our music. And then we just got more and more gigs offered. We played in the gallery somewhere in Connecticut. Wait, yeah. And then we actually rented a warehouse. My cousin had a photo exhibition in a warehouse, and he was like, hey, you could use the warehouse to throw a dance party. So I threw him some money and got the warehouse, and we went in there and like set it up with lasers and fog machines on there that we bought off Craigslist somewhere in Queens. And then we went to a security guard at a grocery store and asked him to come to our party and make sure, like, you know,
the thugs didn't get.
Just, like, make sure, like, it's safe and, like, you know, nobody acts out. Also, the guy that owned the warehouse, like, requested that. So then it was actually really fun and really successful. We made a bunch of money and we're like, wow, we should keep doing this. And we used the Facebook event to invite people to it. And then I forwarded the Facebook event to the Knitting Factory and was like, hey, look, we actually draw crowds. Can we play at your venue? And then they were like, yeah, that sounds, you know... I showed them Facebook events of 2 shows, so I convinced them.
All right, so before we get to the music, let's stay on business for a second. So where did it get formal? Where does Hornblow, where does management? I mean, they only take on people they actually believe in. So how did they hear about you, and how did that all kind of go down?
We were on tour with Mike Doty, who saw us in the subways. He saw us in Union Square L train, cause he lived in Williamsburg at the time. And, we got this email from him asking us to go on a national tour, and we did. And one night we played at the Bowery Ballroom, and Jamie and Pete were there, and they sent us an email saying, hey, loved your music. They sent us an email, and, we actually didn't go with them for another few months, right? And then we decided, you know, it's probably smartest to go with these guys because they manage so many great bands and have been doing it for so long.
We'll cover this in 2 parts. This is going to be the world's shortest version of this question. Let's talk horns and accoutrements. That is all the things you put in your horns. What is the kind of moon hooch test for what makes a horn? Like, how do you choose your street cones? Let's get really geeky here. How do you figure out what kind of strange shite you're going to add?
I think the tube and the traffic cone came about because we were missing a bass instrument. The band started accidentally, and we ended up having two tenor saxophones and drums. So not much bass there.
Yeah. It's almost like a mistake.
So this really actually bothered me a lot, and I really wanted bass. And I went to Sam Ash, tried out a bass saxophone, which was $9,000. And at the time, that was completely impossible for me to buy. So I thought, well, what is a bass saxophone? A bass saxophone is a long tube that creates air resistance to a reed, which in turn makes the reed vibrate slower. And a slower vibrating reed equals a lower pitch. So I came to this very conceptually. And then as I was thinking about this, I saw a bag full of cardboard tubes that some fashion designer must have thrown on the streets. And I picked it up. And I was like, you know, I'm going to try see what happens if I cut these and put them into my saxophone. So I brought them up to my apartment. I was staying with my girlfriend at her grandma's house at the time. And I took a kitchen knife, bread knife, and actually just cut them in different sizes because some sizes would not resonate at all. And at that point, I couldn't really understand it mathematically. I wanted to. I actually contacted the sound engineer who studied calculus, and I bought a book on calculus, and I thought maybe if I understand it mathematically better, I could build a larger variety of tubes and additions to the saxophone. I made some designs. None of it ever amounted to anything. So I just kept experimenting and cutting different lengths of tubes. And then I found a tube that resonated at a C, and we wrote a song with that and recorded our first album with that tube. But then I lost it on the road. Just forgot it somewhere. And we were like, what are we going to do tonight? And we're driving through Iowa, and we saw a traffic cone that was approximately the same size as the tube that we lost. And we picked it up. I went to a plumber's shop with it. And I was like, hey, could you help me with this traffic cone? I need to cut this off and put some rubber on the top so it seals. So we just had a great time like cutting this tube. And he was so excited about it, he actually called up his son and was like, you gotta listen to this. And and that was the story of the traffic cone, yeah.
I feel like most of the time, it's, made as, like, a genuine expression. And then, you know, after it's, like, you know, almost a finished piece, then it's, you know, presented to the band, and maybe it'll become something. Usually it does. Sometimes it doesn't, you know. It's like a song might be written, and then we might do something with the textures, with the, you know, the sounds or the instrumentation, or the compositional structure to make it, you know, either more danceable or even not, you know, not even more danceable, just, you know, something maybe more interesting. Or basically what I'm saying is there's no, like, preconceived way of how we compose structures, and there's no way to tell in the beginning if a song is going to amount to anything or not.
House music with horns, with beats, with hip-hop, so when people try to genre-lize you and they're saying, so house music, but you've added horns.
We've been facing that issue since the beginning of the band. Personally, I hate genres because I'm just so interested in the whole spectrum of sound and music and expression that, so like, say I'm a rock musician or a house musician or a jazz musician is just not accurate. So we call it cave music because when we started, we were playing house music, which is originally electronic, with acoustic instruments. You know, it's like we live in houses now, and we used to live in caves. So we're kind of like bringing the house element, but in a more primal, exactly. But now we can't really say that. It's more like we live in a cave with like a bunch of fancy lights and like all kinds of electronics, because we use a ton of electronics now. We all got really into electronic music production and stuff. So yeah, I guess if you had to call it a genre, you could call it cave music. But even that is putting it in a box, and I'd really rather not do that. So I usually just tell people to come to our show if they want to see what kind of music it is.
So what I've done is I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside. And whatever you tell me to play, I play it exactly as you tell me to play it.